Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to The Waves for Thursday, November 29th. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. In the New York studios, we have June Thomas, senior managing producer of the Slate Podcast Network. Good morning, June.
Hello, Hannah Rosen.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah. What's going on?
Frigid coldness, and that's all.
I know, the last time I saw you, we were in Miami, where I wish we were right now.
I know. We were wearing sandals. I'm sorry, listeners, who missed that show. It was a really fun show. Anyway, we have another fun show coming up, which is a wintertime call-in show. So if you have any questions for us, especially is it sexist questions, call 646-907-9859. We'll repeat that number at the end of the show and leave us your questions. We'll play them on air. Okay, let's get started. Our topics today. We have the squad of young female newbies in Congress using social media to chronicle their public lives. Will that change the dynamic for them as women in Congress? Second, traditional clothing. Why is it going mainstream? And finally, we are going to talk about the Hulu show The Bisexual by Desiree Akhavan, which explores her awkward predicament as a newly discovered bisexual. That was slightly wrong. She's not newly discovered.
No, she's more like that she explores and comes to terms with and kind of comes out, but...
You could just say, like, thank as a you. Bisexual out of a 10-year-long relationship with a woman or something.
I'm going to let June correct me. It's fine. And then in our Slate Plus segment, June, you want to say what we're going to discuss?
Yes. In our Slate Plus segment, we will be asking if the very notion of emotional labor is sexist. And if you want to hear that discussion and support Slate's journalism, you can try a 2-week free trial at slate.com/thewavesplus.
All right. Our first topic, Congress exposed on Instagram. So the new squad of women includes Ayanna Pressley, she's from Massachusetts, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, New York, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. They've been chronicling their first days in Congress on Instagram, on Facebook, what it's like to go through the underground tunnel, what kind of swag bags they give out at training sessions. It's just a whole new view into the first few days of Congress. And I would say because they're younger, they do it, or at least some of them do it, and we'll get into the details, in a way which feels like pretty natural. It's not like that Hillary Clinton way in which it's clear that her young staff is foisting it upon her. So Noreen, can you just paint a little picture of, I mean, whichever one you spent time on, like whichever one you think is like most evocative of this new style of newbie in Congress?
Sure. Well, let's talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in part because she's from New York, and also because, you know, she's become sort of the star of this freshman class, kind of a symbol for both the right and the left. The best description that I've heard or read of her Instagram is that it's like if you or your friend were suddenly elected to Congress, this is how you would act, right? She's sort of like surprised and delighted to be there and wants to let you in on all the craziness. So it is, as you said, pretty natural. Like it's, you know, I think she probably must be aware that she has more people watching than she used to, but she does things like show you the bean sludge that she's cooking in her Instant Pot, right? Which has very little to do with Congress. But she'll also, she showed a photo of the Capitol building and called it Hogwarts. She showed all the badges that she got. She's talked about all the confusing healthcare options. And it is just sort of like, it's almost like lifestyle blogging for Congress, yeah. Right? Where it's like...
It really is lifestyle blog. That's exactly what it is. Like when she was talking about her swag bag, it was like, you know, it's just... It's cute.
Yeah. And she'll do the thing where you have a sort of on your Instagram stories, you have like a blank solid colored background with text that you want to show. But rather than doing like a notes app, you do it in the Instagram. It just shows a facility mm-hmm. that I doubt that many other members of Congress have. And it's pretty enjoyable, I think, as these things go.
OK, enjoyable. So it's enjoyable. We got that. It's enjoyable. She's like me and my friends. Hey, shout out Raul. Like it's very like it's fun to watch. And she's just so fun to watch. Right.
Yeah, for sure.
You're waiting for me to turn. What's the butt? I'm not going to have a butt yet. I'm just like, not yet. I have a lot of thoughts.
I have a butt eventually.
Yeah, I have a butt eventually. OK, but June, before we turn, like, did you watch it? And feel, and I think this is true to different degrees for these different women, like this, where was, you know, when you watch politicians mm-hmm. sort of imagery, mm-hmm. at least me, I'm always scanning for like, does this seem totally natural? Is it totally cliche? Is it embarrassing? Did their staff do it? Like, yeah. You're just watching for how much facility there is in mm-hmm. it. What was your read on these very, like just looking at their Instagram accounts, forget about the stories for a minute, but just like the accounts, like the image they put up of themselves.
Yeah, it feels very credible. It feels real, whether or not it is. I mean, we're all, every single one of us, putting out an image at every moment. So I'm not saying that, yes, this is completely authentic, but it comes across that way. And that's all that matters.
Well, why is that all that matters? This is one question I have is like, why do we fetishize authenticity so much in our politicians?
Well, I think there's something about this particular batch. It's, and we're focusing for whatever reason on their use of social media. But for me, what's so striking about this particular batch of freshmen is A, you know, we keep seeing these things. They're historically young, they're historically female, they're historically diverse. But I would also say they are historically cool. Like, just look at these bloody women. They are so fucking cool. And it's just absolutely obvious. And that does feel different. It feels like instead of people who are, you know, in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's case, 29 and acting like 55, they are 29 acting like 29. And I, you know, as somebody who hasn't been 29 for a whole bunch of time, I don't know if that's real. I don't know if that's how 29-year-olds act right now. But I can tell that they are cool kids. Like, they are the coolest kids. And we're not used to having, I'm not used to having politicians who are cool kids. And that feels both different and important because this is one of those things where, like, I suspect I'm not the only person who think professional politicians, these are not who we should, you know, that's not who I want to be leading my country. But then sometimes, like, especially.
Yeah, that's why we got Trump. Jim.
Exactly, exactly. And it happens over and over again. It's happened in Britain. It's happened everywhere where, like, there's some kind of calling that you have instead of just these tried and tested, and then you get these awful people. In this case, it feels like they are both serious politicians and also cool kids.
Well, in Ocasio-Cortez's instance, too, I think the thing that she wants people to pick up on is not so much the cool kidness as it is the, like, I'm one of you. You know, she got a lot of attention for saying that, you know, she's not sure where she's going to get her money between, you know, the election and starting the actual job. She
renting a apartment in D.C.
Right. She had a hard time coming up with the, like, the down payment, I believe is what she said. You know, she and this is part of her platform policy, too. She's, you know, for working people, obviously. I mean, for me, the thing that was most striking was actually not her Instagram. It was Vogue actually ran a really great story on her. Truly, I think the best profile that has been run of her. And instead of, like, voguing it up, they showed her actual apartment in the Bronx where there was IKEA furniture that I just recognized. You know, it was sort of that, like, 20 something apartment, and it was real. And I, you know, props to Vogue for actually showing that. But Vogue showed that because that is part of her image, right? And Vogue is smart about image making, right? And so they knew that, like, you can't mess with this.
And do you guys, and how are people responding? I mean, it seems like one, well, let me pivot. Like, to me, I don't give a shit if it's authentic. I actually want it to be strategic. Like, I want her to be using this. Like, we are not in an age where, like, it's about being authentic. Like, we're so past that point. So when people scan for authenticity, it's just so wrong. It's like, obviously, we're in an age of image manipulation. And through social media, unless people get smart about that, I just hope she does it from here to eternity, because she couldn't be, like, partly it's just, you know, it's native to her, but partly it's also, like, it whips up this fan base.
Well, it also,
like, Alex is sending me, like, some of the comments, you know, you should be speaker, not Pelosi, heart eyes emojis, you know, like, it whips up this, like this active fan base. And when I watched her on Facebook Live, which I did when she was running, it's fantastic. Like, she's literally explaining, like, people ask her very nuts and bolts questions about politics, and she corrects them, and she explains how it's, like, linked to rent control and how the machines work. Like, it's really good, like, in terms of getting people kind of active and engaged and not feeling 100,000 miles away from political machines and what happens in Congress. It serves a purpose, you know?
It sure does. And that part of politics is about getting votes, and, you know, to assert, she has this double need of, like, you know, bringing support for showing that progressive policies can really build up, you know, strong support, and also that she got elected. I mean, Beto O'Rourke was doing Facebook Live from dawn to dusk, but he didn't win his race.
Well, that's a different situation.
But you know, it's a similar thing of, like, yeah, everybody agrees, I think, that Beto O'Rourke ran a fantastic campaign, that he's, you know, an important politician. Just because he didn't win his election, that doesn't mean it was a failure, but it also is significant. Just in her case, it doesn't, and to a certain extent, it doesn't matter if she's got a fan base outside of her district. What is, in a certain sense, most important is that she keeps getting elected.
With little hers. Like, yeah, her fan base in other places could just be engaged and active in other ways.
Yeah. Well, I think I disagree with you, though, about authenticity not mattering at all. Because I agree, strategy is what matters. I think anybody who doesn't realize that everything everywhere, but especially in politics, is something that has been strategized to a fare thee well, and then, you know, a goal has been set, and then that goal is moved toward. But I think that there is no way that an inauthentic, if it reads, like, it's just like that thing, you know, project sincere. If it doesn't read as authentic, if it doesn't read as sincere, it doesn't matter. That, like, yes, you do need strategy, but the part of the strategy has to be the strategy being invisible.
Well, I think what gets me excited about this, other than Ocasio-Cortez herself, who, like, I'm just, like, I'm in the tank. I will admit it. But it kind of offers an alternative path to Trump, right? Because I think I can see the appeal of Trump if you're so sick of the messaging that has been focus grouped, and you can tell, you can just, like read, you can feel the hot breath of the 33-year-old speechwriter who wrote it and then checked it with his interns and, like, the whole thing. You can feel that in most political messaging, including on Instagram. And this does feel like, you know, Ocasio-Cortez in particular, like, this is what she actually believes about politics. This is what she's coming up with on the spur of the moment, that you feel like she does understand it, that this is how she talks as a human being. She is sort of sharp and funny. Like, she goes back at the people who are trying to, like, take her down on Twitter. And she does it in a funny way that's not sort of Trumpian and cruel, but she, like, speaks in the vernacular. And it's just, it's exciting that you can do the Trumpian sort of connect with everyone's internet id without being like, you know, just a cretin.
And it's interesting, too, how much the right is driven bonkers by her. Mm-hmm. I mean, the famous thing where the Daily Caller journalist, you know, got the photo of her walking in the car and said, whatever it was, you know, this is not a girl who, you know, look at that coat, not a girl who struggled, whatever that phrase was. And that's just symbolic of how she is just, you know, like a cattle prod to the right. She drives them bonkers, but in a way that the thing that drives them bonkers is they are always questioning whether what she's saying is true. And I think that's something I'm very familiar with. It's something that people in Britain, for example, are always questioning, like working class people's class credentials, which is so funny. But like, to me, that's very similar. It's like, you don't question other things, but you want to question that.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly her transparency is both catnip to the left and also just, you know, bonkers nip to the right.
Can I ask you guys about the feminist question? You know, so these are women of color, they're younger. What, you know, do you, part of me is feeling like maybe it gives them some armor, you know, like maybe it allows them not to get swallowed by the system and feel alienated. It's like keeping a link to an outside, a public, a fan base, a language they know, because I bet it's alienating to walk in as a young woman of color and you have the sense that there's an established language here and an established way of being and looking and talking. And they're essentially saying, like, screw that. Like, it allows them to just kind of not get overwhelmed by the way things are, you know?
Well, and not just that, which I think is super important and interesting, but they also are sort of forming their own power structure. You know, mm-hmm. they're not, I mean, and I'm sure that they will do some of this, but they're not sort of, you know, genuflecting at the altar of House leadership. They're sort of making a name for, like, how many freshman congressmen do you normally know the mm-hmm. names of? Mm-hmm. Do you normally know the sort of, you know, friendship affiliations of? But they're sort of going direct to consumer, as mm-hmm. it were, and, like,
yeah.
you know, making their own power structure, which is kind of cool.
It's very similar to the way that, you know, Instagram cut out the gossip magazines or tabloids. And, you know, just as celebrities can go direct to people, so can these Pauls.
Can I throw a little bit of cold water, though, yeah. guys? I have two. Yeah. So why do we want to sort of always consume the lives of women, right? Like, can't we just let them do their jobs without making them be, like, congresswoman/lifestyle blogger? Like, isn't it enough for her to, like, show up and tell us what she thinks about an issue? Does she have to show us the Instant Pot thing too? Would we respond to it in the same way if it were a dude, right? And, like, is this sort of another version? Is this the lefty version of, you know, reality TV politics? And, like, is this bad in the long term?
I did think that looking at Rashida Tlaib also, you know, they're just so attractive and they're so,
yeah.
like, it's just so pleasant to look at the images of them on Instagram and see their stories and, like, how she's always got her ponytail on one side. You know, there's just something so, like, you just kind of slip into that mode of, as you said, like, I'm watching a lifestyle, like, your brain just kind of slips into that mode before knowing it's happening,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you're just looking flatly at the images. And you did think, like, there was one where she was doing, you know, it was probably her, like, 15th hour of live blogging and whatever. And she, I mean, you know, Facebook living. And she just kind of, like, she was like, God, people expect so much of you. They expect you to be on all the time. Like, she just sort of let something like that slip. And it was a weird moment because, whew, it just felt like you could feel how exhausting it was, mm-hmm. and you felt like how is she going to be this person
right.
for everybody forever? You know?
She won't. Like, at some point, her staff will do it. She will hire a strategist, and they will focus like that. Maybe I'm being cynical, but I think that's going to happen. It just as a function right now, they don't have a job other than
right.
this.
You
right. know
exactly.
But at some point,
your basic question. So let's say she is able to do it. Is it a reasonable expectation for her to be packaged like this? Like, is that the next? So all politics, like future female politicians have to be cool, as June says. Like, they have to be able to do this.
I don't know. I mean, like, Beto O'Rourke, again, it seems like he's also in this mode, you know, of his constant Facebook living, of you know, being on all the time and just having that way of making every conversation a political conversation without it seeming tiresome. And so maybe it is just a particular style, not, you know, clearly we're looking very much at these young people and talking about social media because we associate it with, you know, as we've said, it's a native, it's their native language, blah, blah, blah. But it's just one style that is just particularly easy to access. And I don't know.
It seems like the nature of power may be shifting, right? Like the Nancy Pelosi version of power is behind closed doors. She doesn't want you to know how she got where she got because it isn't pretty. And she got it by sort of, you know, there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of dead soldiers, let's say, in the caucus before she gets to where she can do a press conference. And so is power coming from that kind of backroom dealing right now, or is it coming from like populist energy? And I don't know that it's such a clean and easy either or, but it does seem like for everywhere in politics, it's shifting toward the populist energy, which is like, I do think that social media has changed the valence of that.
Yeah. Well, when you brought up Nancy Pelosi, I was thinking about her and thinking, okay, not a native social media user, but what was her equivalent? You know, there's a certain generation of politicians for whom being the first generation of politicians to figure out how to use direct mail efficiently was the key to their success. And like that was their equivalent of social media. For Nancy Pelosi, amazing fundraiser. Like that's, again, we don't think of that as being like a method of communication, but actually that's just what it is. Like there are these different things which now, you know, just by its nature, social media is right in the, you know, it's right there for us to see on our phones. But, you know, I just think it will morph like every other form of communication has morphed. Now direct mail is fallen by, you know, who opens those? Who even gets them anymore? But
can you picture Nancy Pelosi like doing, if I were her social media strategist, I might say, okay, Nancy, every time you eat a chocolate today, which she famously does like round the clock, like just like do a 30-second video like this one's Ghirardelli and it's from San Francisco and just like kind of ironic popping the chocolates in your mouth all day. Would people like that from Nancy Pelosi or would they be like, what the hell is Nancy Pelosi doing?
Yeah,
like, who lobotomized her?
That's a good idea, Noreen. Rather than try and fake your way through the day. You know, because it's not a young person thing. It's Trump who brought this upon us, by the way, and he's in his 70s. It's like him who, you know, just amped up the kind of direct to the populace way of governing. So, yeah, why not? That's actually a funny idea. I would like to see what Nancy Pelosi wears when she's not wearing a suit, personally.
Oh, man, I can't even picture like maybe I'm picturing a cashmere kind of tracksuit. What do you guys think?
That's a lovely thought.
Like Olivia. I always think you can tell like who's rich and who's not by their leisure wear.
Yeah.
Like because anybody can suit up. Everybody has like one good outfit or one expense. Everybody does. But leisure wear, like that's where you can sort the classes. Right, June?
I'm sitting in my pajamas right now, so I've got no comment.
Well, listeners, if you have been trolling the Instagram accounts of any of these newbies in Congress or your own newbie in Congress, please let us know at thewaves@slate.com or on our Facebook page or tweet to us what you are thinking about these accounts, whether you like them, and if you think they are a good thing.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
All right. Our second topic today, the revival of traditional clothing. All over the world, in Germany, in India, in downtown New York, people are taking up versions of traditional clothing that has basically been out of fashion for like 100 years. So what is that all about? I can't really make sense of it. June, give me some examples of like what you're wearing right now. No, just like what's an unusual thing that people have started to take up?
So there have been this whole series of stories in newspapers recently, possibly just a coincidence, but who knows? So one in the New York Times is about the revival in China of Hanfu. So this is a version of what people believe China's Han ethnic majority wore before foreign domination. So these are like centuries old clothes. And I'm sure that like in China, it's not like if you walk around, you see a million people wearing them, but there are people wearing them. And I think too.
Young people.
Exactly. There was also a story about how in Germany, in Bavaria, around Oktoberfest, young people are wearing dirndls and lederhosen like to go clubbing. It's not just that they're wearing it to go to some like throwback traditional situation, but they're actually wearing them. And, you know, maybe in a sort of casual way, you know, a torn or, you know, there was a mention of cutoff lederhosen. And, you know, as somebody who spends time in Japan, I often see women in kimono, it's always, even though I now expect it, I always still I'm shocked to see like literally dozens of women every day in downtown Tokyo wearing kimono.
Yeah.
And it's I've always also been a little bit obsessed with this because I remember when I was a kid, we used to watch Miss World as a family. And one of the parts of Miss World was wearing traditional costume, which of course meant sexy traditional costume. And I remember specifically in 1973, when, yes, I was alive, there was a controversy because they made this traditional costume, as they called it, compulsory, and the America and Britain didn't have one to wear. And so the two Miss UK wore Elizabeth I costume, sexy Elizabeth I. Mm-hmm. And Miss
That's like sexy Handmaid's Tale.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Miss USA wore like sexy Uncle Sam costume. Mm-hmm. And like, it's weird that it's not weird for America. America is a nation of immigrants. There's no traditional clothing. But still, it's a very interesting condition to me that there should even be a concept of traditional clothing.
Spoken like a colonizer.
true.
Well, so this is really interesting to me. There seems to be a global reaction against globalism, mm-hmm. and a young person's reaction against modernity. And these are not necessarily people who are politically conservative. We don't know that.
Right.
It seems to actually have a real hipster element. There was, you know, I clicked around on some of the women in China who have sort of become social media stars for wearing this. And it sort of reminds me of like when burlesque was a thing 10 years ago, that kind of like mm-hmm. Dita Von T's vibe, where it's kind of old fashioned pinup-y. It's sort of the Chinese version of that. And Germany's a super fascinating case. It's not like Berlin clubbing, it's like Munich clubbing.
Right, right.
And Germany's a particularly interesting case because, you know, to talk about going back to sort of like traditional Germany in Germany like fell out of fashion after Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the young people are insisting that it's not in any way about that. At the same time, as a separate sort of thing, like German nationalist rock has become a thing in a very alarming way. So I don't think that this is exactly linked to the rise of sort of you know, nationalist groups in the authoritarian way necessarily, but it does to me show that young people are craving, they just want to be able to say, I am German, I am Chinese, I am a particular thing. I am not a sort of Facebook data piece. I am a particular thing, and I'm going to express it in this by wearing a like super old-fashioned piece of clothing. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to turn back the clock.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So you mean it's about like clinging to a sort of tribal identity, or like what do you mean? Like people feel generic? Like people just feel like.
Well, I mean, it could be about a lot of things. It could be people being like, you know, it's really boring, jeans and a t-shirt. And, you know, it's really beautiful, this flowing silk situation that is connected to history and craft and a specific time and place. It could just be that. It could be purely aesthetic. But it seems to be. How could it not be about feeling tribalism if you're literally, in the case of China, saying, well, you know, we are an ethnic majority and this is how our ethnic majority needs to dress because that's how we dressed before the invaders came. It feels to me like people do want that. People want to feel specifically grounded in time and place. And I think young people in particular have all grown up with this sense of like, I could be anywhere at any minute. I'm interchangeable with someone, you know, across the world, and I want to assert that I am not. I am a particular being. I have particular, you know, geographic and historical ties.
Yeah, and that's why I find it so interesting. But also, I have as much as I think it's really cool, I also, there's a part of me is like, but this is such a nationalist, mm-hmm. you know, vibe that the one of the pieces, the piece that I read about the you know, the situation in Bavaria was. One of the women who said, you know, people see me in my dirndl and say, wait, are you German? This is a German woman who happens to be like a woman of color. I don't know what particularly was her heritage. And so there is that thing of like nationalism, you know, even nationalist sort of things that I've enjoyed, you know, like I am very interested in, for example, the Basque nationalist revival. But when you come down to it, there is a like, our people speak this language. This is for
totally.
Us. And then when you start to get that, you're like, oh, God, no, I don't like. Yeah, OK, you've gone to a point where I do not like. And yet I do think that you're right, that there is at the same time, more consciously, this feeling of like, why have I rejected this super cool way of dressing?
Is it super cool? OK, so this is my other issue with it.
Wait a minute. But are you sure it's even spontaneous? Like, it's not like there are some instances where it's been actually promoted by governments, like mm-hmm. in China and India. Like there yeah. is a sense in which yeah. there's a sort of manipulation of nationalism. Yeah. Like it's not a clean force in our world today. Like tribal affiliation is not like, this is so cool, I want to feel grounded on the earth. It's also like a very ugly force.
Yeah, exactly.
There.
Absolutely. And there are certain places where that is definitely true. In China, there is nothing, I think, that is just happens. I mean, everything that is it, that kind of messaging comes in some form from the central government. And I think, too, in what was the other example you gave?
Well, India.
Oh, in India, yeah. too, you know, there we have, you know, definite forces of Hindu nationalists. And there are definitely issues around that. But I think in Germany, that feels that feels like a more organic springing up.
Yeah, and I'm not necessarily endorsing it when I'm saying that. I'm not into this style of dress myself. But I do think like the pump has to be prime for people yeah. to be receptive yeah. to that kind of top down thing from the government. My other thing that I wanted to talk about is that you know, women's progress has often been reflected in clothes for better or for worse. But you know, as women gained more rights, their clothes got more comfortable, got more assertive, got more free, and in like just the construction of the clothes, right? And so some of these outfits are A, constricting, and B, really emphasize certain aspects of femininity. Like a dirndl is sort of a corset construction. It's not as tight as a corset necessarily, but it's sort of saying, okay, this is what a woman looks like. And it wouldn't be very easy to sort of walk around an office in Hanfu garb, you know?
Right. Well, and kimono, which are gorgeous, they're so beautiful. And it always like kills me that there are women like on the subway wearing kimono and people aren't standing up or even noticing. Like, this is a gorgeous garment that costs also hundreds of dollars. It's like walking around in a ball gown. But when you are wearing kimono or even yukata or you know, the other kinds of traditional dress that women wear, like hakana, you can't walk very well because, you know, you can't open your legs very wide. You're restricted. The clothing restricts your movement. You have to wear geta, which are those weird wooden sandals that you certainly couldn't run in. Even, I mean, people who are used to them can walk in them quite well, but you're never, you know, that feeling of like, you're never going to be able to run away from someone wearing this. Like,
so what do you guys make of that? That's sort of like, you know, it's never been good for women to go backwards generally. So what do you guys, what is that about?
Yeah, I don't think that's great. Yeah. I mean, that brings me to Bathsheba, who is a fashion designer, Bathsheba Hay, who's a fashion designer in New York City, who is from Hana, is an Israeli, I think her parents are Israeli immigrants from Queens. And she went to Stanford. Is any of this sounding familiar, Hana?
There was so much Queens, like Alexander, like Ocasio-Cortez is always like Queens this and my headquarters in Queens. Anyway, there's a lot of Queens in this show. It always makes me happy. Yeah.
Anyway, so she went to Stanford, went to Georgetown Law, became a sort of corporate lawyer in New York City, and then left that career, married a very downtown like fashion photographer who in about 10 years ago became what sounds to me like ultra-Orthodox, if not Hasidic, right? He was already, I believe, Jewish, but became observant in a very different way that comes with all kinds of constricting traditions, right? Particularly, you know, around the way women behave in that kind of relationship. So she married him and they moved to the Upper West Side. They have two kids. She no longer works as a lawyer. And she obviously, from this New Yorker piece that we read, that didn't sit entirely easily with her. She has a somewhat different relationship to religion than her husband does. I think her husband has, you know, he really loves the traditions. And I think those like didn't sit so well with her. She talks about, you know, when she had these two kids, she would stare at these stills Cindy Sherman film stills where, you know, Cindy Sherman was dressed up in this like sort of housewife outfit. And she would look at that and think about it, like her own kind of role and what was happening to her. And then at the same time, she had this vintage Laura Ashley dress remade. Now, Laura Ashley is those of us who remember the 80s. Remember, it's like a certain kind of
Pre-Raphaelite.
Yes.
Kind of look.
Old fashioned floral, the volume, a lot of volume. Mm-hmm. And she had it remade to be like almost a caricature of itself. And she had a bunch remade and they became a sensation. And they didn't become a sensation necessarily among Orthodox women. And she also made versions of this for children, thinking that this would be like fun for kids. They didn't become a sensation for kids. They became a sensation for adult women, particularly sort of like fashion-y downtown sort of cool girls who wanted to dress like they were on the prairie or in Victorian times.
6 years old also.
Yes, 6 years old. 6 years old,
also
totally.
6 years old.
Yes.
Yeah. No, really, like Lena Dunham was really into it.
So what do we think that's about? Is that returning to like the prairies of America, or is this a reaction to like, you know, decades of wearing fewer and fewer clothes? Is it like the last way to transgress is to sort of become a traditionalist? Like what's happening here?
Yeah, I remember somebody called them don't fuck me dresses, you know, so in that sense they...
Do you think it's a Me Too reaction like that? I don't buy that theory personally.
Because it's sexy in its way?
Well, right. There is this sort of like, I'm in a cult. You don't know what I'm going to do.
Well, the other thing, too, is that, you know, when you have a lot of fabric and volume and like it seems like Bathsheba Hay often uses like heavy corduroy. If you're not skinny as fuck, you're going to look gigantic. So you're still, in a sense, showing off your body, even when you're completely covered from head to toe.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. I cannot imagine myself in one of these. Although our co-host, Christina Cotterucci, wore, I don't know if it was a Bathsheba dress, but she wore a version of this style to our live show and she looked great. Like, and we should have called Christina and asked her, okay, tell us about like what you like about these dresses.
Yeah, it is. It's like, don't fuck me, but it is look at me. Like they're very stylized and unusual. And it's almost like walking around in costume.
Yes.
You know, it's like on the edge of dress up. That way.
And
they're
I
not
love that.
Modest in the sense of like don't notice me, you know. They definitely like turn the head, these dresses. They're like metallic and they have rose and they sort of ruffles at the neck and you know, and they're cinched. It's not like they're not baggy, you know?
They're probably fun to wear. I think that's probably part of it. Like, you know, it feels like something genuinely new. Like, fashion is trying to recycle trends at you, and you're like, oh, okay, bell bottoms again. All right, excited. But this is like, it's an event to wear it, probably. And I do think there's something about, like, this is the last transgression left. That, like, how do you sort of go counterculture in a culture where just about everything is permitted, and that is sort of a liberal piety that everything is permitted, and the only bad thing you can do is say that someone's choice is wrong, right? it's something about that.
Well, I also love the idea of dressing up. I love the idea of wearing a costume. And since, you know, at other points in time, we might have felt like dressing up in a costume might have been like appropriating someone else's clothing. Like, I remember going to see The Ring. So you're there every night for, you know, you're there for four nights over the course of a week. You see the people sitting around. There was a woman who sat in front of us, a white woman who wore a sari. And like, it looked cool, but you're like, yeah, I can't really do that. But like, putting on something that is, it's almost like an event to, you know, put on these clothes. That there's a coolness to it. And so if you can do that without, you know, being offensive, that's kind of cool.
Right. I went to my first Indian wedding not so long ago, and I was so nervous. I kept asking the bride, are you sure? Are you sure? And I wore a sari and like had the best time. But to the point about appropriation, so Bathsheba Hayes' husband is this fashion photographer. And when they were dating, before she had sort of gotten fully in on the ultra-Orthodox movement, they went to Hasidic Williamsburg, and they essentially dressed her up like she was an ultra-Orthodox woman, and they did it like a sort of fashion photo shoot, as if Vogue were doing a shoot in Hasidic Williamsburg. And she obviously has a somewhat I don't know the intricacies of their marriage or her religious life, obviously, but based on the New Yorker article, she has an uneasy relationship with what is required of her in this version of Judaism, and what the sort of gender roles are here. And so she is playing with that. Is she appropriating it? Like, that's sort of complicated, right? Because it's not like Hasidic women are wearing Laura Ashley dresses in Williamsburg, but there is something that she's thinking about and working through there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the dresses are not, it's not like wearing a sari. Like, if you look at the dresses, some of them are cut short, some of them have crop tops. They're not obviously referencing a single culture. You know, they're sort of referencing lots of different things. Mm-hmm. So I feel like you do see her mind kind of trying to work something out in the designs of the dresses, you know?
I think maybe that's also what people like about it, is that it's intellectual fashion, is that it is like a Cindy Sherman photograph where you're like thinking through stuff.
Yeah, and she's not a designer like her, but she's an attorney who, you know, clearly has some sense of it. But, you know, she is very open that, like, I don't know how to do certain parts of this. Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing about maxi dresses, which are considered, you know, modest clothing for some people, like, they're incredibly impractical in an office. Like, I've seen women in our office have to kind of roll them up a little bit so that they don't get caught in the wheels of the office chair. You know, there is also a need to be practical. You know, like, we do live in a world, you know, where we're going out after going to go through turnstiles or ride a bike or even get in a car, you know, like driving in a maxi dress must have its challenges.
Yeah. When you put on one of these dresses, you're not projecting, I operate with an air of modern efficiency, which might be the appeal to some people. But to me, that is the non-appeal.
Interesting. That makes me want to buy it ever so much more. All right. If any of you have been wearing traditional clothing and particularly to work, let us know about your experiences. TheWaves@Slate.com.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
All right, our third topic, The Bisexual, is a new Hulu show by Desiree Akhavan, which explores some themes in her own life. In the show, she plays a character called Layla, who splits up in the first episode with her long-term partner, female, and finds herself wanting to date men. It explores her awkwardness around being bisexual. She was a little uncomfortable with that label, so she tries to reckon with what that was and what it means, particularly in her gay world. June, I'm going to make you answer the first question, just for random reasons.
Yeah, random.
So the episode starts with this dramatic breakup, mm-hmm. She's trying to make it a non-dramatic breakup. What did you think of that as a launching for the story? Like, I'm breaking up, I'm going to be free. Did it strike you as believable?
Yeah, it did. I mean, it's funny because there's just 6 episodes, 30 minutes episodes. It is told in a very naturalistic way, I think. Everything seemed very believable to me, everything about it, including something that I didn't really see mentioned in the reviews, which is just the weird experience of being an American in Britain. I mean, the show, I don't know if you mentioned, Hannah, is set in London. That's where Akhavan lives now. It was originally made by Channel 4. And like that was,
and she's Iranian, so it's like, yeah, in that world, right, too. It's exactly like a slightly immigranty, slightly urban kind of scene,
right? And that was just so well done, and like the feeling of being an American, an Iranian American in London, just surrounded by people who are just acting fucking miserable all the time, and just like dealing with people who will never express a second of joy to you. Even when they love you.
I did not pick that up.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Even when they love you to pieces, like clearly her friends love her, but they would never, like, did any of them ever smile? Did any of them ever like indicate that at all? No, not at all. But
do you think that's British, or is that like the immigrant? Like, is
no,
that British,
British
immigrant?
It's,
like,
who? No, it's British. It's a completely British thing. And
her friend is like the best, though. Like, that's like, she's like the best sidekick ever.
Yes. Although it's funny, like the fetishization of Dennis seems weird to me. And again, another misunderstanding of this show, which I saw in the American press, is for some reason. So the partner that she breaks up from, the girlfriend that Layla breaks up from, Sadie, is an older white woman, played by Maxine Peake, amazing British actress, who I'm just going to mention right here, went to my school, at least for the sixth form. She didn't go all the way through, but whatever. And so she's from up north. She's a real northern. She's also a total lefty. But she is so not posh. She's the opposite of posh. She's totally common. She's from fucking Burnley. And in like Hulu, on their description, they said, she breaks up from her posh girlfriend, like, yeah, totally posh, except absolutely, totally the opposite. And like,
wait, can you tell in the show that she's not posh?
Yeah, she keeps saying, I'm from Burnley. And she also, like, she's working class. She's got a northern working class
accent.
Wow,
that went over my head.
And the fact that they didn't stress that in any way, like, because obviously you're making it for Britain, but Akhavan knows that Americans are not going to get it. But she still put that in, and I absolutely love that. So I thought, like, that stuff. So one of Dennis, who is an amazing character, who's great, like the reviewers.
Just say who she is, because I just said that without saying who she
so
is.
So Dennis she
like works in a shop where her mom works.
She works in the family shop. She's Turkish. I mean, she's British. She's Turkish British. She works in an off license. Her family's off license. And some of the, and she also is.
What's an off license?
It's a liquor store,
okay,
but a package store,
right,
kind of. A bodega. It's a bodega.
Okay, that's what I thought it was.
Yeah,
a bodega.
But it stays open later than other shops, so. And one of the reviews, the American reviews, talked about how she brings in like the class consciousness, which actually she's not that working. I mean, she works in a shop, but her parents own that shop. You know, like it's not, they didn't quite get the thing. But and then because at some point she says to Layla, you're so middle class. But again, that's just the most British bloody thing to say. It's just, it doesn't, it's a, it has so many other valences of meaning that we're just.
I feel like June is like, the lesbian issue is just like, she doesn't care.
Oh, those are fine too, but it's all the British stuff. Exactly.
I enjoyed I enjoyed watching someone enter the world of straight relationships. And there are a few little moments that I thought were done really well, where she's sort of discovering what it's like to date men, and sort of like reorienting her world. And she's very eager to sort of like sleep with a man for the first time. She's convinced it's going to be totally different. She's delighted to find that sex itself is actually, as she keeps saying, it's not that different. Like, the sex itself is not that different. But there are these little moments where she talks about sort of like, oh, the cleanup after sex, that's different. Right. Or my absolute favorite was she's trying to hook up with a guy she barely knows. She meets at a club. She thinks he's cute, but she doesn't really talk to him. He goes to the bathroom. They're going to go get a cigarette outside. And she's trying to figure out whether to take her coat on or off because she has, she doesn't shave her armpits. She's like dated women like, the women she's dated have liked her not having armpits. She's already had an existential crisis. Do I like armpit hair? Do I not like armpit hair? And then she has to do this, like, do men like armpit hair? Do they not like armpit hair? Is it better to show my arms and my like back or put the coat on so he doesn't see my armpit hair? And she takes it on and off. And you can see just like within like 2 days of dating men, it's already like eroding her confidence.
Right. Exactly. And I loved how all the sex was different. Like some, you know, the first guy that she manages to have sex, like, is just this really noisy kisser. Mm. And I thought, oh God, like, is that how she kissed? And then like, no, it was just him. Mm-hmm. And like all the people had a different way. And like, that was really, because again, it's a pretty short show. And to just kind of have that depth, yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, and also to have the interrogation just go backwards, because I'm sure, like, it's normally like, wait, what is the gay thing again, and how does it work? So it's just like have a show in which you just like the norm is like just seems completely weird, you know?
Yeah.
Like the heterosexual norm is just like, what? Like that's like yes, that's how it works, you know? It's just like really, really great vibe kind of running through the whole show. I have a question about the term. Like she does this thing. She had this thing where she was like, part of the inspiration for the show was that she was constantly being described as bisexual, like bisexual filmmaker, bisexual Iranian American, bisexual Lena Dunham, whatever. She said this in an interview. Is the term like the term bisexual? I was thinking about it a lot. Is it like, do people believe it? And like, is it a betrayal if you're, does it fit into queerness? It somehow feels to me like it's outside of queerness, like it's uncool in some way. Or
I think all specific labels are getting to be considered uncool. Like it's so much more comfortable for a lot of people to use the term queer. That is just because it's an umbrella, and it's because it soon will have its own baggage. I mean, it had baggage before. It'll soon have baggage again. But I know exactly what she means. Like, there are certain, like, I'm a lesbian, but there are, like, just using that term, like, it sounds uncool. And, like, you know, we had an entire entire special issue of Outward that was about lesbian. And many of the pieces were about the term and, like, our discomfort with it for so many different reasons. Christina Carterucci, Waves host, had a fantastic piece about it. So, yeah, there's definitely something about, like, a word that you're not uncomfortable with an identity. You're not uncomfortable with who you are. But, like, using a certain word just, like, does something to your skin.
Or it closes you off from other possibilities or something.
And also, I should say that there definitely are issues. Like, bisexual erasure is a huge thing. And bisexuals do get treated badly by both straight people and queer people. And
which the show really shows.
Yeah, exactly. And there are, again, like, very small, not overworked moments where, for example, Sadie, her girlfriend or at some point ex-girlfriend or who knows, says, like, I know you're bisexual, I'm never going to be able to satisfy you. And like, that's silly, but it also is something that I know people think. I know they do. Or like, you know, you'll always be looking around. Like, why? Like, but definitely people think that. You know, there are so many misunderstandings or stereotypes or whatever about bisexual people, and it is an identity that is poorly treated by everyone.
Right. There's one of their group of friends, like, always hooks up with straight girls, and they always make fun of her for that. I think it's Layla.
That's normal.
I think it's Layla who goes on a riff about how saying that she's bisexual is tacky because it, like, connotes, you know, Tila Tequila.
Right.
Right. This sort of, like, looking for attention kind of opportunistic thing. And I really liked, I don't know if you guys made it this far, but so Layla, after she breaks up with her girlfriend, moves in with this guy, Gabe, who's sort of like, you know, every sort of jerky male writer, but maybe with a heart of gold. We're still finding out. He's hooking up with one of his students who's, you know, 10 to 12 years younger than he is, or 12
to
15.
That was amazing. I love that.
So she is, you know, she's a young college student. And in one scene, she says to Layla, they're all sort of, you know, drunk or stoned or something. She says to Layla, well, I'm queer. Like, why do you sort of label yourself in this way? And Layla goes on a really interesting riff about, like, everyone under 25 says they're queer. And like, that seems great. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I think that's like good for the world. And that seems like an easier way to be in the world. But if you're someone my age, you know, which is not that old,
right.
It's like early 30s.
Right.
If you're someone my age, you had to sort of define yourself in this other way. And to then go back on that after all the work and the coming out and the everything, and to just say, yeah, like maybe men too, that feels like some kind of betrayal. That mm-hmm. that to me felt like the heart of the idea that she was exploring in the show.
Yeah.
But also, why? Because, you know, was she'd basically only slept with women until that point, until she almost but not quite hooks up with the guy from the club. And so it's just, why does she cease to be a lesbian, you know, in that moment? Like, in the same way that when someone said this woman only sleeps with straight women, why are those women still straight if they're sleeping with?
Well, I mean, there's two things, of course.
It's like how you feel, or what is it? Like, does she genuinely feels attracted to men? So she feels like, well, okay, I woke up, I kind of am bisexual. It's not that I just want to sleep with.
It's a difference between behavior and identity. And, you know, you might just as in the way that, like, I was a lesbian before I had any contact with a woman, like, you, it's what you know you are. And even when she's been sleeping with women, she has been bisexual for as long as she's known that she also has that attraction. It's not about behavior necessarily. It's, I mean, just as mm-hmm. there are, you know, especially guys, I think, but guys who have sexual contact with other, you know, they have sex with other men, but they don't see themselves as gay. They might, what they're doing is gay, but they don't take on that identity. And so I think it is a difference between identity and behavior, which, you know, like, is again, it's this like a way that bisexuals are erased is when a bisexual has a long-term relationship with either a woman or a man, and people say, well, but you're straight now, right? Or, well, but you're a lesbian now. And like, no, I'm still bisexual. Like, I'm in a relationship. Like, that doesn't take away my identity. It doesn't take away who I am. It's, you know, and that's a very basic thing that makes bisexuals crazy. But, you know, there's, again, it's a difference between behavior and identity.
Well, there's also, she said a thing that I wonder if it's controversial in the queer community, that both the character and the creator have said that if, as a teenager, if I had sort of like basically been pursued by a guy in the same way that I was pursued by a girl, that if my first relationship had been with a man, I wonder if I would have been gay at all, right? And I wonder but I wonder how that kind of line of thought is received.
Well, I think that's one of those things, in my view, only my view, that's something that everybody has those questions, right? I mean, everybody, you know, what if I had done X instead of Y? And I don't think she's saying I wouldn't have been who I am. It's just like, I wouldn't have pursued this. I wouldn't have thought about this. I wouldn't have allowed myself to think this.
It would have been an easier path.
Possibly. I mean, except it wouldn't have been because she is who she is. You know, she isn't. I think it's, but I think, so I, in my interpretation, that's something that people ask, but that doesn't mean that they really believe it.
No. So we're just supposed to understand she was not that she was suppressing this in some kind of oppressive way. It's just like it was there. It bubbled up occasionally. You know, she had kissed a guy and it was just there. And now she just felt the need to explore it because somebody asked her to marry her. And she was like, if I marry her, that option is closed off. And I just never figured that one out. So I can't marry her. I've got to figure that one out.
I mean, I don't know if it's quite that. That's definitely a legitimate point of view. I think that in a certain sense, she realized maybe she didn't want to be with Sadie forever. And if they were kind of broken up, then sure, like this is something that she's curious about. And this is something, she, you know, that she maybe clearly hasn't said to her friends. So, you know, something that she's been holding inside in a way that she is exploring it. Yeah. And physically as well as mentally, so to speak. And she's like moving. It also seems to, you know, it's, I think in many ways the show's about transitions of, like, you know, getting older, moving into a different kind of relationship. You know, there's also a question of whether she and her partner or her partner alone will have kids. It's like it's like that moment where you're like, okay, I'm going to commit to one thing, whatever it is, whether it's a label for your sexuality, just a way of how you're going to live, where you're going to live, who you're going to live with. It's about that, or you know, what country you're going to live in. Like who are your friends going to be?
I appreciated that as someone who's of roughly equal age with her, that sort of when she breaks up with her partner, she like sort of moves backward in time and she sort of is having fun with it. Like she's going out a lot. She's dancing. She's like staying out super late. And she also sort of knows it's inappropriate. She goes to a club and she's like, she doesn't have her ID. She's like, look at my face. I don't even belong here. So I that sort of like 30s as era of, you know, deciding what you are in an actual concrete way as opposed to your 20s, but being a little uncomfortable. I enjoyed that as a portrait of that moment in time.
Yeah.
It sounds like we are all into it. We're going to like
love
it's
it.
A two, yeah. three thumbs up situation. Yeah. Okay. Well, everyone go watch it. It's The Bisexual, Desiree Akhavan, and it is on Hulu right now. So go check it out and tell us what you think. thewaves@slate.com or tweet at us individually as a collective, or on our Facebook page. All right, recommendations. June, what do you have?
Oh my God, thank God that last weekend was a long one, because I may have been a completely terrible worker if I'd had to go to work, because I was so obsessed with the Australian podcast, The Teacher's Pet, which is in some ways a bog standard true crime podcast. The audio quality is often terrible. The story is a little bit repetitive if you listen to it in one sitting rather than over the course of several months. But oh my God, it is so compelling. It's a true crime story that's told in a sort of gentle, non-exploitative way too. It's about a woman who disappeared in 1982. No body was found, but it seems very clear that she was killed either by her husband or after in a murder arranged by her husband. But the police have been completely useless. The director of public prosecutions has been completely useless. And so it is both an exploration. The husband and his twin brother were football players. It's just there's so much interest. Like, again, I was about to say fun, and I pulled myself back because it is a story about a murder and it's true. And people lost their friends and their mother and their sister and all of that. But it's really quite well done. So I really recommend The Teacher's Pet.
Cool. Sounds great. I am going to recommend a novel called Severance by Ling Ma. It's her first novel. You know, I love a good office novel, but this is like an apocalyptic office novel. It's like a post-apocalyptic world, which has been destroyed by a certain disease, but it's also completely like a novel just about mundane office life and why I left New York. It's in that genre of like why New York sucks, you know, and I got to get out of here. It's just mundane and insane at the same time. And it's just so well controlled. I love it. It's like a great first novel, Severance by Ling Ma.
Cool.
Noreen.
I am going to do a meta recommendation. I'm going to recommend a Recommendation Engine, which is a newsletter by the writer Molly Young. I think it's called Read Like the Wind. But I think if you just Google Molly Young Books newsletter, you would probably come up with a way to sign up. She just has great taste. And she doesn't recommend new books for the most part, which is what I really like about it. So usually, I mean, there's like always at every given time, there's one novel that everyone's hyping and you read it because it's the thing that everyone's talking about. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not good. But this sort of cuts against the hype machine. It's just like great books from a bunch of eras. She's a really sharp, incisive writer. They're like smart little, you know, blurbs, essentially. If you like this kind of thing, you'll like that. So she, in this week's issue, or this month's, I don't know how often she does it. It's an occasional letter, let's say. She recommends Mrs. Bridge by Evan Connell, which I love and maybe have recommended on this show here. It's sort of like an old novel that people love that isn't, you know, once you hear of it, you love it, but it isn't necessarily top of everyone's mind. The Reluctant Fundamentalist by the same author who wrote Exit West, which was a more recent sort of acclaimed book. She just has a great taste. And then at the end, what I really love, there are these little one sentence recommendations in the manner of Diana Vreeland's Why Don't You from Old Time Vogue. So why don't you try Minor Willa Cather if you like the idea of Henry James, but less of a bitch about people with bad haircuts. So so Molly Young's book newsletter. Check it out.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much to our producer, Danielle Hewitt, to our production assistant, Alex Barish. You can email us at thewaves@slate.com, or you can tweet us individually at June Thomas, at Noreen Malone, at Hannah Rosen. If you want more information about this show, go to slate.com/thewaves, and don't forget to leave us a message for our call-in show. And is it sexist question you have, or basically any question you have for us? The number, again, is 646-907-9859. For June and Noreen, I am Hannah Rosen, and The Waves will be back next week. Bye.